Hi, welcome to this week's program. As the American humorist Mark Twain used to say, there are lies, damn lies, and then there are statistics. And in the financial world, few things are more dangerous than the statistic known as average. Here are two examples of the folly attributed to the word average. Can you drown in a lake whose average depth is 6 inches? Yes, you can. If the center of the lake's depth is 40 feet and the depth at the shore is less than an inch, the average depth may be 6 inches, but you could be in trouble. Can your body temperature be 98.6, but you could still die from overheating? Yes. If you had your head in the freezer and your feet in the oven, you may die with an average body temperature of 98.6. Now, these are some silly examples to make a point. The statistic average can hide many a dangerous situation and obscure the real facts. Economically speaking, we often rely on averages to get a sense of how the economy is doing and how well labor force is doing, for example. For instance, the average rate of economic progress looks pretty healthy at the moment. But a deeper dive into the numbers shows a wide disparity between the rich and the middle-income Americans. On average, things are looking better, but only because the average numbers are overwhelmed by the gains made for the wealthier among us. So, once again, by wading in a little deeper, you can see through the distortion that the word average is concealing. For those reading this commentary online, I've provided a chart from Yahoo Finance. This chart shows that the lowest 25% of wage earners have experienced living expenses growing faster than their income. Middle-income earners are basically treading water, meaning their income growth has just kept pace with higher costs. The biggest winners are the highest 10% of wage earners, yet on average, the numbers look rosy. See what I mean? The statistics measuring household borrowing are also subject to the discrepancy. Recent debt-to-income numbers were hailed as good news because although households borrowed more, consumers' income rose alongside of it as well. This made it seem that consumer debt was under control and stood at a reasonable percentage relative to the income needed to pay it off. The so-called debt-to-income ratio stood at 86%, which was significantly lower than its all-time high of 116%. In 2008, at the peak of the housing bubble. This suggests that American households are financially healthy and are not experiencing levels of stress covering their payoff of the debt. But once again, these average numbers don't highlight the difficulty lower income households are having to pay off that debt. According to the Yahoo Finance article, a more sophisticated analysis found that when comparing people's net worth against their net income, rich households who have benefited from a rising stock market and rising home prices show healthier balance sheets. These same ratios have deteriorated for households at all income levels except for the top 10%. The report goes on to say that these lower income families are more fragile than ever, suffering from increased debt, stagnant or declining wages, and lack of assets. Now, there are differing opinions as to whether the economy is in for some economic peril or things are all right. But it is never a good sign to see a large number of already vulnerable people making decisions which, if the economy turns sour, may blow up in their faces and cause the poverty cycle to repeat once again. Anyway, getting back to today's theme, remember that any statistic that uses the average or mean rate of something needs to be looked at more carefully, if only because the underlying numbers may tell the truer story. So if you can't swim, make sure the depth of the lake you're venturing into is proportionate to the average depth and something that you can handle. If it is in fact too deep in some parts, wear a life jacket or stay in the boat or at least, at the very least, get yourself some water wings. You're listening to The Steve Pomeranz Show. John Hennessy is professor of electrical engineering and computer science, and he has also served as president of Stanford University from the year 2000 to 2016. Among his other accomplishments, in 1984, he co-founded the semiconductor company MIPS Computer Systems, which went public in 1989 and was eventually sold to Silicon Graphics for a little over $400 million. He is the co-author with David Patterson of two internationally used textbooks in computer architecture, and he has a new book, Leading Matters, Lessons from My Journey. And by the way, he was recently appointed executive chairman at Alphabet, which is Google's parent company. Professor Hennessy, President Hennessy, I don't know what to call you. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Steve. Just John will be fine.
Okay. Now, I've served on a number of nonprofit boards. I've been president of boards, and I did all this while running a business and doing a radio show. But your list of accomplishments are so incredibly wide and diverse. How do you find the time to do all these and then to excel in them?
Well, I'd probably say first and foremost, my career has been my hobby. I've been passionate about computing and computer science for a long time. So it came quite naturally for me. I used to tell students, people who are good in computer science will stay up late at night to program, not just to go to parties. I found that passion early and it was easy. Later on, as I took on more administrative roles, I had to think more constructively about taming my schedule and ensuring that I had adequate time to think about long-term strategic issues.
Well, as president of Stanford, I'm sure that was a big administrative job as well as a leadership job. Am I correct in that?
You're correct. And it's one that you can only tackle by building a team and become comfortable delegating to your team responsibility for important things.
Yeah. Well, Stanford as an institution is one of the world's leading nonprofit educational institutions, and Alphabet is one of the world's most profitable companies. So what are the main differences in leading these two types of disparate large institutions?
Well, there are certainly differences. Clearly, the objective function for the two kinds of institutions is different. Who your constituents are that you serve as a leader differ. In the academic setting, you have everything from families and faculty and students, alumni, while in the for-profit sector, you have shareholders and customers and your employees. But I think there are also some surprising commonalities between them. I think getting leaders who will focus on long-term strategic outcomes for their institutions, whether nonprofit or for-profit, I think is a crucial thing right now.
Well, the rate of change is different within these two types of institutions. I mean, I think universities have the ability to look out 10 and 20 years, whereas companies are forced to look at the next quarter and to look for guidance, otherwise they're going to be punished on Wall Street. I mean, the rate of change is so different. How do you manage between those two?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The rate of change is very different. Universities change slowly and pay a lot of attention to the past, but they do need to change. In both cases, both for companies and for universities, innovation becomes a core value, something you have to be committed to in order to get it to change. Now, the pace is different. You're absolutely right about that. I think in companies, the challenge for so much of the leadership is not just to look at the next quarter, but to look at the next 5 years and to remember that you don't want to make short-term trade-offs that will benefit the quarter at the cost of making the wrong decision for 5 years from now.
Well, in your book, you write about the role of the university, and I project this also to the government, to support and propel private industry. Your development of computer technology when you were at Stanford was perhaps something that could only have been done in a university setting or maybe a government setting. And actually, the internet started from government research at all. What do you think the role of the university and government is to support and propel private industry?
Well, I think government and its investment in the research infrastructure in our country, that's the primary way in which we've generated new economic growth. You know, when I came to Silicon Valley 40 years ago, it was still mostly farms. And there were a few early semiconductor companies. There were essentially no computer companies at the time. And things have changed dramatically. Yeah. Much of that financed by government research. Google, Yahoo, lots of companies that had their roots in originally government research. I think what we have an obligation as a country, and looking at both sides of the aisle, whether you look at industry or you look at academia, we have an obligation to try to take advantage of those investments that the government has made and turn them into economic growth as well as other good outcomes for society.
You know, we talk about cultures of different Industries, and this is a book about leadership. The new book, by the way, is Leading Matters, Lessons from My Journey. My guest is John Hennessy. The stereotype of Silicon Valley's culture is that they're rebellious upstarts. And is that a culture that makes good leaders?
I think it's a culture that is changing and must change, Steve. When I started in the Valley, our startup companies and the companies we're building built products that primarily touched the lives of other engineers and techies and maybe people in the business sector. Now you look at the products coming out of everything from Uber to Facebook to Google. They touch every person's life every single day. So that requires that the leadership think very differently about its responsibility to its customer base than it did in an earlier time. And I think that's evolving, quite frankly. I think this has happened relatively quickly, and the industry and its leaders are catching up with the implications of those changes.
In your book, you discuss core elements for the basis of leadership: humility, authenticity, leadership as service, empathy, and there's more: courage, collaboration, innovation, curiosity, storytelling, and legacy. When I think of the stories of Steve Jobs, which spoke about how brutally honest he was because he didn't really care what people thought of him, and that seems like a very big stretch for most corporate leaders today. And that's under the authenticity banner. It's one thing to be authentic, but it's another to kind of cross over behavioral lines. Can you discuss that?
Yeah, I think you've raised a very good point. I think Steve is sui generis. I mean, he is perhaps unique in the entire high-tech industry. He not only founded Apple, he got fired from it. He went back and he saved the company. He really saved the company and turned it around and made it a great company. There are very few people that have that sort of history and that sort of charisma and ability to do that. So I think we have to accept that we're not Steve Jobs. We perhaps have less command and control capability than Steve had, and we have to find ways to leverage the rest of our support team in order to be successful.
I'm discussing the new book, Leading Matters, Lessons from My Journey, with John Hennessy, former president of Stanford University, and on and on. So in your book, or throughout your book, you discuss the idea of taking necessary risks. How does risk play in this role in one's leadership journey? Because taking a risk, as I tell clients in my investment advisory business, taking a risk doesn't mean you're going to get a reward. It just means it increases the probability or the possibility of a reward, but it doesn't guarantee it. So, you know, I especially am thinking about these large companies that have seen success doing things a certain way for so many years. Industry changes, but they don't see that industry change, and they don't take the necessary risk.
You're absolutely right. I mean, a successful company that's built a very successful product, that one of the biggest dangers to them is that they continue to invest incrementally in that product without doing the new thing. I still remember the board discussion where Google decided to buy YouTube. And here you're buying this company that's putting up free videos and letting people have access to them, and getting the vision that video was for the younger generation, what email and text was for my generation, really helped everybody understand that this could be a transformative, admittedly high-risk purchase, but could really be transformative. I think people who want to change their institutions and want to see them get better and thrive have to be comfortable with some sort of risk. It can be an educated, thoughtful risk, but they have to be comfortable with it.
I'm speaking with John Hennessy, former president of Stanford and now executive chairman at Alphabet, Google's parent company, and we will be right back to continue this discussion. StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. I'm back with John Hennessy. We're talking about his new book, Leading Matters, Lessons from My Journey. For those of you just joining us, John Hennessy is the former president of Stanford and also chairman at Alphabet, Google's parent company. John, we were talking about leadership and the difficulty of large companies to take that kind of risk. And you were talking about Google's purchase of YouTube. And as an investment person, I was thinking, I mean, there's no earnings there. There's little revenue. There's only possibility. And yet they were, I forget what they paid, but it seems like these numbers are always in the billions. How is that kind of price or those kinds of prices so justified?
Well, I think you have to then build a financial model that indicates how you will be able to monetize that purchase eventually. And for Google, the advantage was it had an advertising network that could take advantage of YouTube's reach and figure out how to make that a significant and substantial business. So I'm in favor of doing bold things, but not bold things that aren't underpinned with a strong analysis and a strong rationale.
Mm. You must have made numerous mistakes in your long career. And I think for many, there's a fear of making mistakes. You know, I always say there's no sin in making a mistake. The only sin is not learning from it. What were some of your most challenging failures, and especially with regards to self-examination, would you really, you had to realize something that you were doing was wrong. Does that bring to mind any event in your life?
Surely. I have had several setbacks. I mean, early on, when I started a company, Steve, I knew a lot about the technology. I didn't know the first thing about organizing and running a business. So as part of the executive team, and you might argue that it wasn't my responsibility, but we let the company expand too fast, and we had to do a layoff. I mean, we almost ran out of money. We had a near-death experience for the company.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lesson for me to learn, that I had to learn more about the general management side of the business if I was going to be participate as a leader in that company. I had several setbacks on the academic side. We tried to do a few things. Probably one of the biggest was a new campus in New York City that we had an invitation from Mayor Bloomberg to compete for. And in the end, for a variety of reasons, we couldn't pull it off. We couldn't get to yes in a way that would satisfy both the needs of Stanford as well as the needs of the city. That was a big investment, a lot of time. It was an interesting lesson in understanding the dynamics of working with a public sector entity. And so I think we learned things from it, but it didn't work out. That's fine. We can step back and say that didn't work. It was a big risk. It was a big try. We'll go a different direction.
You spoke about having to lay people off in this new company that you were starting where you grew too fast. In your chapter on courage, you described the decisions you had to make as president of Stanford after the financial crisis of 2008. You had to figure out a way of still serving your constituency while serving, you know, the ability of the institution to remain solvent. How did you deal with that?
That's a great question, because it was a real challenge, and most universities were worried about doing the right thing. So first of all, we made a decision. We were not going to cut financial aid for students. Look, we were going into an economic crisis, a recession. Families were going to be more stressed, not less stressed. So we decided to stand by that. That implied if we were going to realign our budget with the new reality of what our endowment was worth, we lost billions and billions of dollars out of the endowment.
Well, 25% I read in the book.
Yeah, 27% roughly of the endowment vaporized in a relatively short period of time. So that meant we needed to cut elsewhere, and we decided we needed to do a layoff, that we couldn't just hold our breath for an extended period of time, which would have turned out to be 6 or 7 years in reality.
Mm-hmm.
And wait for the market to get better. So we decided to do a layoff. And the first thing we decided is the provost and I both cut our own salaries so we could send a message to everybody that this was a serious situation, and the university had to realign its finances if it was going to continue to thrive.
Was there consternation from the faculty that you were cutting the students a break, you were continuing to, you know, keep your financial aid package intact, and yet they were being laid off and their salaries were being frozen?
Nobody would have spoken against the students and student financial aid because it's such a core value for the university. But they did say other institutions are not taking these kinds of dramatic reactions. The fascinating thing is a year later, they changed their mind because we had 1 year of pain and then we were back on course. Many other institutions who decided to cut at very small amounts every year, some of them are still budget cutting today, 10 years later, in order to get alignment.
What is that, death by a thousand?
Yeah, death by a thousand cuts.
Cuts, yeah.
And that's what I did learn in the startup environment. I learned if you're going to do a layoff, do it quick, get it over, and move forward.
Rip the band-aid
off. And that's not traditional in the academic setting, nor in many large companies. But in a small company, you have no choice. And that I found that worked better.
John, who do you go to for advice?
I have worked with a variety of different people over time, both some fellow board members and CEOs. But since I also had a board of trustees with significant learned people who had great experience, so I found my board, particularly my board chairs, really served as mentors. I also built a culture among my senior staff where they were not afraid to come in and say, you know, John, that's a really stupid decision you're about to make. You shouldn't do it. And getting your staff to help you avoid mistakes is absolutely crucial.
The end of the book, you have a whole chapter on the books that you have read that have influenced you. What book are you reading right now?
I'm reading Ron Chernow's biography of Grant, which is simply spectacular. It's going to do for Grant what David McCullough did for John Adams and Truman. So it's a spectacular book.
Well, that chapter includes books from Abraham Lincoln or about Abraham Lincoln, FDR, Churchill, and topics ranging from science to history and living a good life. May I recommend two books for you?
Surely.
There's a book called The Thread Across the Ocean by John Steele Gordon, and it's the story of laying the first transatlantic cable.
Ah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Talk about against all odds, that type of thing.
Right.
And then a book called Against the Gods, The Remarkable Story of Risk by Peter L. Bernstein.
Oh, great.
That's a wonderful book. So I just wanted to throw that in there. So let's talk about leadership again. Is it possible to have a company with co-leaders, two people of equal rank trying to run a company?
It's difficult, I think. It may be as a holding pattern. I think long term, what I've actually seen in some organizations that have done this, what it actually leads to is a slowdown in the decision-making process. So it's not that deadlocks and outright fights occur. What simply happens is when the two parties are not on the same page, they just don't make the decision and move forward.
Yeah.
And so in the end, I've seen it work as a holding pattern, but I've never seen it work in the long term.
Well, you're dealing with two individuals that have reached the pinnacle of their prospective companies or institutions. So not only do they have vast knowledge and leadership skills themselves, but I'm sure their egos are pretty big.
I'm sure.
So you're bringing together that mix as well, right?
Yes. Yep. And so it makes it just more difficult. You know, in the second startup that I helped co-found, a company called Atheros that built one of the first wireless chipsets for Wi-Fi that are now everywhere, we had a point where it came time to replace the CEO, and we started a search, and we just had a hard time finding somebody. So we started operating the company in the interim as sort of an office of the president with three or four people leading the company. But what happened was one person emerged as the clear leader.
Yeah.
And the rest of the team actually came and said, you know, this is the person we should make CEO. So it worked out, but it was a risky approach to leadership in the company in a startup.
What is your day like? I mean, some leaders talk about practicing daily meditation and a 4-day work week and so on and so forth. How do you handle the stress and also the demands on your time?
Well, I'm religious about exercising every single day. I found back when I became president, if I didn't do that, not only was my physical condition not as good as it would be, but the stress levels were higher.
Yeah.
And learning to manage stress, I think, is a critical issue. You have to learn to do it, or you cannot do the job. You can't do any of these jobs very long without that. So that's where I start. I normally, if I have something serious to do, like write something or put together a presentation, then I'll reserve the first hours in the morning, the early morning hours, for doing that, rather than let them get used up with email and other things, which don't require as much attention and focus as putting together a presentation or writing something.
My guest has been John Hennessy, former president of Stanford University, and also winner of the Turing Award, which is recognized as the highest distinction in computer science. It's like the Nobel Prize of computing, and he's now chairman at Alphabet, Google's parent company. His new book, Leading Matters, Lessons from My Journey. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Steve. I enjoyed it.
And remember to visit our website at stevepomerantz.com to join the conversation, listen or read all of our segments, and sign up for our weekly update. And while you're there, for all the important topics we've covered, remember that they'll go straight to your inbox every single week. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So, used to be that you would want to get a mortgage and you'd go to a bank, but now that is starting to change pretty dramatically. Non-banks are lending money. What is that all about?
You know, the non-banks are lending institutions. The traditional banks are the big ones that we know, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, the list goes on. I hate to say it, but it's easier to get a mortgage. It seems like you have less hoops to jump through.
Or paperwork, perhaps.
When you go directly with a lender. And this is my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So in my perspective, so sorry if you work for a bank.
Mm-hmm.
I find it a lot easier to deal with a mortgage lender that's not tied in with the bank. You can reach them at night. You can reach them different hours. It's just an easier, cleaner experience.
Well, you know, there is a way to kind of differentiate between the bank and the non-bank. So obviously, Wells Fargo is probably the number one bank issuing mortgages, and then comes JP Morgan Chase. But the third is Quicken Loans. See, there's a non-bank offering mortgages. You just gave me a face, so we won't say what you really think about Quicken Loans, but that's not the point. In terms of volume, they're number three. And there's a lot of smaller companies coming up behind them that are kind of taking this over. And I don't know for sure, but it seems like they would be subject to less regulations because, you know, the big banks have been operating under new laws since the crash.
Right. I just think that my opinion is they just don't want to lend money anymore. They're going down a different direction with their business model. And these mortgage lenders want to lend money.
Well, let me tell you what could be a possible hiccup in this whole idea. According to the article, these non-banks are borrowing money on the short term.
Right.
So they're getting short-term rates, which are probably in the 1 to 1.5, let's say. And they're lending long-term, and they're getting 4.5. And that spread is where they make their money. Well, if short-term rates rise, which they are rising.
Yep.
And of course, you're lending at a fixed rate.
Yep.
There could be a point in time when the amount of spread between the two narrows, and that can hurt margins. And then if it narrows too much, it can actually really hurt the balance sheet and bad things can happen.
Sure.
Yeah. So just nothing that we have any control over, just something to really understand. Okay. So prices of residential real estate are high.
Yeah.
And we're still in a seller's market.
Technically, yes.
Technically? What does that mean, technically?
You know, real estate is local, so it really depends on what's happening in your neck of the woods.
Mm. What is happening in your neck of the woods?
In my neck of the woods, I'll break it down even further. It depends on price point. So, for example, our medium-priced home in my marketplace is in the high 5-6 range. When you hit the $600,000 mark, we're really in a balanced market, meaning it's neither a buyer's market or seller's market. You get under that, it's still a seller's market. You go above that, especially once you hit the luxury market, it's very much a buyer's market. So
now, in different communities, luxury markets could be different price levels, right?
That's right. I mean, technically, I think we draw the line around $750.
Mm-hmm. If you lived in San Francisco.
That's a poor man's house.
It'd be like $10 million. That would
right.
be luxury, you know. So, okay. So what about starter homes? Sellers or buyer market?
Very much a seller's market. Mm-hmm. I wish I had a million of them.
So. Okay. All right. So basically, there's a report that 2 out of 3 economists surveyed are thinking that this market's going to continue until 2020, and then it's going to turn. I mean, that's a prediction, right?
It's a prediction. I mean, there is a shift coming. Every market has a cycle. We're starting to see the slowdown a little bit. We're seeing the pullback. We're seeing the pullback because the pricing has gotten too high.
Yeah.
And when you look at a medium, let's take an example. If you're making $100,000 a year and you can afford a $400,000 house, well, your income's not rising. That $400,000 house keeps going up, 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 up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, eventually what happens is the $100,000 income people can't purchase those homes, so those prices are going to start to fall back down.
Right.
Supply and demand.
Okay. And a buyer has the choice now of either buying or renting.
That's
and
true.
And then you get to this part of the cycle where sometimes it's better to rent than it is to buy, and sometimes vice versa.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So according to the material that I'm reading, it's starting to be more of a renter's market.
A tipping point.
Yeah.
Now, here's the secret. When they calculate this, you have to take into consideration the money that, in order to make it work, you have to take into consideration what your rent is and what that rent would be if you were to purchase it.
Mm-hmm.
But the secret is you have to save that money, the difference.
The difference. And that is the point. So let's say you have a $2,500 mortgage versus a rental for $2,000.
Right.
Okay. For those numbers really to work, you've really got to save that $500.
That's correct.
And most people don't do that.
No.
But listen, as a financial planner, let me say something here. You've got to have money in the bank. You've got to have at least emergency funds in the bank in case something unsuspected happens. God forbid, a car accident or something like that.
What is it? 6 months
six
income?
6 months. Yeah, yeah. You know, it also depends. If you have a job that's in a cyclical industry, let's say you're in construction, and that goes up and down, you really want more.
1 year.
Right? But if you're, let's say you're a doctor and you're in an industry which is pretty steady, you don't really need that because the chances of you losing your job are probably pretty remote. So it has to do more with the kind of work you're in. But 6 months is a good average for sure.
Okay.
You know, I'm always looking for signs of overheating, and I don't really get the sense that the housing market is hot, hot, hot. And I think one indication is this idea that home flipping is hitting a 4-year low.
Yes. You don't see it much.
You don't see it much anymore. Why is that?
Well, the home flippers, they were taking advantage of purchasing the distressed properties because for them, a home flipper is all about profit margin.
Yeah.
Now, how much money can I make out of it? So they gravitated to the foreclosures and the distressed sales.
Mm-hmm.
And quite honestly, they don't exist. I mean, there's some out there,
yeah,
but
course.
Not to the scale that we had.
So the more that a flipper has to pay, and usually they have to then go in and spend some of their own capital to improve the property, make it ready for sale, the spread, again, that word, the spread between the two starts to narrow, so it becomes less economically attractive.
That's correct.
Okay. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, You can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on Contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
You're listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. My next guest is Barbara Corcoran. You all know her as one of the sharks on ABC's hit TV show Shark Tank. Barbara Corcoran's credentials include, I'm sure she's proud of this, straight D's in high school and college, and 20 jobs by the time she turned 23. But it was her next job that would make her one of the most successful entrepreneurs in the country when she took a $1,000 loan to start the Corcoran Group. Barbara's joining me right now. Hi, Barbara. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, Steve, for having me over. I appreciate it.
You know, you're no stranger to starting from nothing. I interviewed Damon John a few months ago, and his start was...
I love that Damon. I love him. He's my favorite.
Yeah. He was great. It was a great interview. And, you know, his beginning was as humble as yours. He started out in Hollis, Queens with literally nothing. How did you get going?
I got going because I did have a lucky break when I was 23 at that diner one night when a customer walked in and asked, sit at my counter, which was just potluck. He could have sat at the other one. And he became my boyfriend. I had never had a boyfriend before. And he offered me a ride home that night. And a year later, he said to me, with your big personality, you'd be great at real estate. And he offered to give me $1,000 to start a brokerage firm. And that's how I got my start. It was certainly good luck. I like to think I earned the luck because I worked so hard. I probably worked harder by the time I was 23 than most people work by the time they're 63. But it was second nature, and I just felt like that was just a lucky break.
So did you think he was crazy, or did something inside you say, you know, I guess I got nothing to lose here. I'm a waitress at a diner. Let's go for it and see what happens?
No, I didn't think he was crazy at all, Steve. I thought to myself, hey, why not? I've tried everything else.
Yeah.
I mean, I had had my fair share of failure, both in school as a dunce. So anything outside the classroom in my book was okay with me. Just let me out of that jailhouse where I could function, you know.
Yeah, you mentioned that your dad had worked as a foreman and kind of hated his job, and you saw this person you were dating now as having money and seemingly happy. You thought, hey, why not?
Yeah, why not? You know, sadly for my dad, he would have been probably a good entrepreneur, but he had 10 mouths to feed in a two-bedroom flat. You know, so that really was the one time that he did go in business for himself. The very first check he received was for $1,000. And in those days, picture that. I mean, so many years ago, that's today the equivalent of getting a $20,000 check.
Yeah.
And what do you think my brilliant dad did? He showed it to everyone at the dinner table. We passed it around. Everybody got to look at it. He cashed it, and we went on vacation and blew money. I mean, not the best formula for success or prudence.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's still my memory of the entire best week of my life, as it is for all my nine siblings. So maybe he did the wise thing. He gave us that memory instead of a business for himself.
Well, that's great. But, you know, after some while, you got dumped by your boyfriend, and he owned 51. What's that?
He just had second thoughts. He was dumped.
Oh, okay. I thought he was going to marry your secretary.
Yeah, he did. He told me he was marrying my secretary. I guess that's called being dumped, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
But he had 51% of your business, so how come you just didn't fold and walk away?
You know, I didn't have the confidence to fold and walk away. After all, remember, he found me at the diner. He took me out of my little town of Edgewater. He said he believed in me. He became my mentor. He was my partner. He was 10 years older than me. And he moved me to New York City out of the little town in New Jersey. So in my warped sense of reality, I thought that he had made me, as though my parents had nothing to do with me. Of course, they were the ones who actually made me and taught me the gumption I would later need. But With that kind of thinking, I thought I would be nothing without him, and he traded me in for a younger model, so my ego was injured.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting in the sales pit with my salespeople because his new wife moved into my seat and shared his office, so it was insult after insult. So with that kind of self-selected kind of self-beating of my own brain, I guess, I didn't have the gumption to stand up for myself. It took me a year, but once I did, it was great. I just walked in one Friday morning and said, hey, guess what, we're chopping up the business today, you take the first salesperson pick, I'll pick the second. We chopped it, 14 people in half, and I started a new business that following Monday. And so I was a little slow on the uptake, but I got it done, and in the end, that's all that really counts.
Yeah, so would you say that, you know, we all have to deal with rejection and handle it? I know you have some thoughts on business and rejection. Was that kind of your first big test, do you think?
No, my first big test certainly happened in first grade when Sister Stella Marie, the nun from hell, called me stupid just because I couldn't learn to read or write. I didn't learn until I was in seventh grade. But I went through school as a stupid dunce kid who had to read out loud and learning shame in the classroom. And that's a horrific thing to put a child through. And I didn't know it then because it was so injured. It hurt so badly. But I learned later that was perfect training for going into business. I mean, I could be a loser in any situation, be an underdog, be insulted, be kicked, be laughed at, and I've been there before. It's like, oh, it's second nature. I'm used to being an outsider. Mm. And if you're going to build a business, it's a great power you have if you could really just take the strength from inside you. So when I'm fumbling for confidence, which I did for the first 2 years on Shark Tank, I could barely speak up. I don't know, by the way, if anyone noticed, because the men overpowered me.
Mm-hmm.
But when I learned to speak up, because I had to pull down inside myself, because I'd been there before. You know, it's just another version of the same old crap that I had lived again and again in many situations. And so it becomes second nature getting through failure, really. And now it's interesting. Every one of my usually successful entrepreneurs have the gift of getting through failure. They are great as losers, basically. They're good losers, you know? And they have the great ability to think fast on their feet and change with whatever obstacles are flying up in their face. And that is a mark of any great entrepreneur. I have no doubt in my mind. I've seen it, lived it, tested it, invested in it. I'm a great real-life case study from the inside and from the outside.
My guest is Barbara Corcoran. You all know her as one of the sharks on Shark Tank. And Barbara, let's talk a little bit about Shark Tank. One thing that's interesting, I thought, is that in Shark Tank, each of the investors are looking to own a share of the business, but you guys are investing in equity in the business. Now, when your business started to grow and you needed money to grow, did you give away equity like those on the show, or did you borrow money to do it?
Well, the problem with small businesses is it's very hard to borrow money. You know, when you can get money from your local friendly banker, it's always in the years when you don't need any money.
Yeah.
You get the credit lines, you get the loans for expansion, because everything's jolly. But when things are bad and you have just as good an idea and maybe even more opportunity to do something special because everybody's laying low and not spending money, you'll never get the money. It's just the way of the land, right? And that's why you have new online people lending money, like OnDeck, who's actually the leader in the online lending to small businesses. But you get those opportunities now, thank God, which we didn't have back then. But what you must do, even if you get the money, is you have to spend it wisely. And I can tell you from working with many of the entrepreneurs I've invested in on Shark Tank, a lot of them don't have good business judgment. They're quick to hire a PR agency versus make a sales call.
Yeah. I wanted to talk to you about that.
Yeah, they're quick to buy a fancy new car instead of funding the inventory that they're going to need if they could only believe they're really going to get a big order.
I wonder how many people you talk to are in love with the idea of being an entrepreneur, but not really in love with making a business grow.
You know what? It's not even about whether they're choosing to love or not. Everybody's in love with their idea, like the hot chick. You know, oh, she's amazing until you marry her or him, and then you have to live day to day with another human being.
Right.
Same kind of parallel.
Okay.
But what people don't know until you walk the talk is you really don't know how tough it is to build a business.
Yeah.
It's nothing but a string of obstacles and disgruntled people, really. And you have to so believe in what you're running for and so believe you're going to get there that it makes the struggle worthwhile.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I would echo you when you said you wonder how many people are in love with being entrepreneurs. Of course it's cool to be the boss. Of course it's cool to be in charge of your own destiny. But get yourself in there building a business through one tough year, and it's not so much fun at all.
So on Shark Tank, Barbara, first of all, I know you get asked this question a lot, but everybody wants to know, who's your favorite person to partner up with?
I would have to say Jim and Saban from Cousins Maine Lobster. They're 30. They're darn good looking. They flirt with me all the time on every business meeting. They even have the decency when I take photos with them to airbrush my face and send it to me so I look their age. In fact, I wouldn't have even been on to it except about 3 months ago. I'm looking at one of the photos and I'm like, wait, I don't even have a nose. What happened? That's when I realized they're doing too much airbrushing, you know?
Yeah.
So they're my favorite, of course, because they're great guys.
Yeah.
And all my other favorites are people I'm in love with, more than the business. What do I know about lobster? Nothing.
Right.
Okay, I've learned. But what they are is they're great entrepreneurs.
What other shark do you like to team up with?
Oh, you just switched subjects.
I did.
Man, that's all right. I love teaming up with Damon because he's 150% genuine.
Yeah.
What you see is what you get. I love teaming up with Mark because he is so wicked smart in technology, which is an area that I always struggle to learn. I feel back at school and flopping on it, you know? And he has so many big bucks.
Yeah.
So having a big fish like that in your business with you is even comforting to me. He's got billions. I've got millions.
Yeah.
That's a big difference. They're my two favorites.
One of the things that Damon said that I thought was interesting, he said his least favorite was Mark because Mark's got billions. And $1 million is a rounding error to him, and he'll pay $1 million just to get you out, you know, to walk away. He said if he lends you $20 or gives you $20, he wants to see your dental records. So
Damon. Oh my gosh, I don't know if that's actually fact, but that would fit definitely. You know what is Mr. Wonderful adores more than anything else cash.
Yeah.
And he earned it very hard, and he's not so apt to give it away so quickly.
Yeah.
He's just a cheapskate.
You know, but I noticed, how many deals have you done on Shark Tank approximately?
Roughly 32, 33 thereabouts.
Right.
And maybe four in the process of closing right now.
So there must have been a couple of thousand presentations. I mean, I did some math. I don't really know what the math is.
With me. That's a great thing for me to use. My God, I never even thought about that.
So you really keep your cards close to the vest. You know, you wait for the sweet deal. And, you know, you're not really bidding on every deal. As a matter of fact, when I watch the Shark Tank, I know that a lot of times you're very quiet, you know?
Well, let me give you the truth on why I'm so quiet. Remember, there's an editor that edits to take an hour and a half and make it 5 minutes.
Yeah,
that's
crazy.
Yeah. But the reason I'm quiet, I'm not blaming the editor. I'm blaming myself because I will try to talk probably 10 times for every one time that I could actually get the sentence. Because the men mow right over me. But to your earlier point, what I'm really waiting for on Shark Tank is someone to fall in love with. When I fall in love with an entrepreneur, I will buy even if I don't like their business. Because you know what I've learned in 6 years or 7 years now on Shark Tank is that if I have the right entrepreneur, they'll reinvent that business because that's the nature of the beast. They reinvent every day in reaction to the obstacles of their work. And so I have confidence. But if I don't love the entrepreneur, not like them, but love the entrepreneur, I don't bid on them because you know what? It never works out for me. I've learned what my MO here is.
Talking with Barbara Corcoran, of course, she is one of the sharks on the ABC hit TV show Shark Tank, but she really is also known for building a big business in a very tough environment, the Corcoran Group doing real estate in New York. You know, I was looking as I was researching for this interview, I noticed an interview with Inc. magazine, and you gave a number of your best advice tips. I'd like to go through a few of those, if you don't mind.
I love to hear them. I always forget what comes out of
your mouth. Yeah, I'll tell you. So the first one was on the topic of instinct. And here is the quote. Don't you dare underestimate the power of your own instinct.
Mm.
What do you think about that?
I wholeheartedly agree with myself. You know why? If you really think about all your best life decisions, and I'm not talking about business, let's say you're working for someone in a mundane job, but think of your personal life. All of your best decisions in life were out of the gut. You know, just they are. You didn't like that guy, and I don't know why. Well, you'll soon find out why you didn't like him after you marry him, right? Or you do business with him. Or you didn't trust this gal. I don't know, something about her is off. I feel like I can't put my finger on. Well, you're going to find out what you can't put your finger on when she becomes your best friend or whatever. You really have to listen to that inside intuition. And it's kind of weird, I think, for me, because everything in our education system says listen to your left brain. Everything we're taught. is listen, you know, analyze. A leads to B leads to C. But in real life, it doesn't work that way. A leads often to F and then jumps back to B. You know, and so the only piece of your mind that's able to grasp that and sing the truth is your intuition.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we hammer it out of ourselves in our school systems, which I'm all against, maybe because I was a lousy student. But one thing I have is great intuition on people. I am rarely, I mean, can't say always, but rarely wrong.
And you're looking for someone with street sense.
I'm looking for someone with street smarts, and you know what else I'm looking for? It might sound like a non-business trait. I'm looking for someone who's thankful. Because let's say everything goes great, we build a huge business and we sell it for millions, and I take my chunk of cash off the table one day. I want to take it off and have a partner that we hug and we each say thank you.
Yeah.
You know, because that thankfulness gene sprinkles itself over the whole process of building that business. I have done, not often, maybe one or two Shark Tank businesses, where the minute it's going well, it's almost like people get greedy. Like, how did I miss that character flaw? What do I want to spend my time with that jerk for? And I really want nice people. You only get to live once. You don't want to go back and wish you should have done it to somebody better. Your judgment on people is so integral to your happiness in life.
My guest is Barbara Corcoran. You all know her as one of the sharks on Shark Tank and also the founder of the Corcoran Group. And don't forget to find out more about Barbara and to hear this interview again. Join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. Last time, I covered part one of a Wall Street Journal article entitled Investor Know Yourself, and that focused on the touchy-feely aspects of investing, which are as important as fact-based research. Fact-based research helps you form a sound mental framework that keeps your emotions from governing buy and sell decisions. And as much as one may be in denial of this, emotions do mostly influence investor actions, either overtly or covertly. I also mentioned 4 points tied to risk aversion, also evaluating and learning from your investment successes and failures, and the problems of overconfidence on beating the market. So now let's talk about your level of conscientiousness and discipline. How would you describe yourself? Would you say that you're organized, responsible, and thorough? Would you say that you're always prepared, paying attention to details and following a schedule? How would you answer that? Definitely, somewhat, or not at all? Psychologists use this question to measure conscientiousness, attention to detail, and planning. Conscientious people are generally ambitious, have low risk tolerance, and a high propensity for regret. And this typically stays the same as we age, with women more conscientious than men, so the psychologists say. Conscientious people tend to save diligently, invest conservatively, track their trades, and stay invested for the long run, and as a result, have fatter portfolios. So consider bringing a certain level of organization and responsibility and discipline into your investing ways, because these traits will boost your portfolio. And like everything else in life, you don't want to go overboard with this conscientious thing. Here's another. Ask yourself, are you the life of a party? In other words, would you describe yourself as enthusiastic and talkative and outgoing? Would you say you don't mind being the center of attention, that you feel comfortable around people, and that you tend to start conversations? Choose your answers. Definitely, somewhat, or not at all. If you choose definitely or somewhat, here's what I want you to know. You're probably more of an extrovert than an introvert. So you're high on confidence, which is great, and you're going to have a fairly high tolerance for risk, and typically not regret your actions, but tend to move forward. All great traits to get ahead in life. But make sure your extroversion does not keep you from listening to the pros and cons of your investment decision. And make sure you analyze bad investments and learn from them, as opposed to ignoring your losses and confidently driving right back in with overconfidence in your investment prowess. While extroversion is good for success in life, do not let it get in the way of your investing success and adapt it positively to aid your portfolio's success. You get that? It's really important. Overconfidence is the cause of much investment failure. All right, here's another one. Are you a generous spirit? Would you describe yourself as appreciative, generous and trusting? Would you say you sympathize with others' feelings, take time out for others, and make people feel at ease? Your choices are definitely somewhat or not at all. Which would you answer? Again, a generous spirit is a most wonderful thing, but make sure you don't trust people's investment recommendations blindly, but follow up on recommendations with your own analysis and have the strength to not invest, even though someone you trust said you should buy a certain security. And as I always tell people, you may be there when they said to buy, but hopefully you'll also be there when they said to sell. And if you're watching TV and you get a buy recommendation, hopefully you're watching the show where they told you to sell. Those who have a generosity of spirit may tend to take other people's ideas too strongly. It's also accompanied by a desire to accommodate others and seek their approval and shy away from doing risky things. So don't get overly risk-averse. With stocks, you have to take on some risk to generate returns. And this level of risk is a low, acceptable risk tied to making investments in solid companies well worth taking. And finally, are you a worrywart? Would you describe yourself as anxious or touchy, unstable? Would you say you are easily disturbed and irritated, easily, and worry about things? How would you answer? Definitely, somewhat, not at all? Well, of course, we all worry to some extent. But if you answer definitely or not at all, you may want to factor this into your investments and adjust for it. Worrying too much or not at all does not help your investments. Worrying too much especially does not help because in volatile markets, you'll worry yourself into a mess and engage in irrational, emotion-driven behavior. So recognize your behavior and consider distancing yourself from your portfolio by hiring a qualified financial planner or investment advisor to make decisions for you and leave the worrying to him. Be involved only to a point where you're fully aware of how your money is being invested and the returns is generating so someone does not misappropriate your funds or get too aggressive with them. But beyond that, cut the umbilical cord and let a professional take over. So, Mr. or Miss Investor, know yourself and manage your personality traits such that your portfolio benefits from them with or without you. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform, and of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomeranz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomeranz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomeranz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.